Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, and this is a dirty little secret of the internet, of tech, of Silicon Valley, and I bought into it. The idea is that you use an app, you take a picture of something, and magically it gets transcribed. Like if you take a picture of a receipt, it magically transcribes into the expense app that you're using. Or if you, I don't know, record an interview like this and there's someone who does a transcript, it feels actually like it's a machine that does it. Like there's some OCR that really takes that receipt, takes that piece of paper and transcribes it, but it's not. It's people. The magic is people. And the guest who you're meeting today is the guy who runs a company that basically does a lot of this stuff for other companies, companies that you know. You probably used him indirectly and didn't even know about it. His name is Mark Sears. He is the founder of Cloud Factory. They provide on-demand API-driven workforces to scale your business in the cloud. This is the company that so many of the businesses you know are using. And we're going to find out how he went to Nepal, fell in love with the country, and then that trip helped create this business. And this whole interview is sponsored by two companies. The first will help you send out email that actually converts and gets you more customers. It's called ActiveCampaign. And the second company will help you get your next great team of developers. It's called TopTal. But first, Mark, good to have you on here.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm excited. It's great.
Can you throw out a couple of the names of companies that we might be surprised to hear are actually using you?
Yeah, I think there's kind of two modes, right? So I love magic. The magic is people. That's great. And sometimes it's humans at scale that are acting like robots behind the scenes. And sometimes we're training up the robots. So, you know, obviously you mentioned things like receipts and invoices. So companies like Expensify, Bill.com, you know, we're processing receipts, invoices by the millions behind the scenes, fairly real time. Other companies like Microsoft, Drive AI, and a lot of other great companies that are building really cool ML algorithms, machine learning stuff. You know, again, we have humans at scale that are really training up those robots.
How? So, ML is machine learning. How are you guys training their robots?
So the only way that robots really learn nowadays is by getting massive data, training data sets that really tell them what to do. So we literally, you know, you look at self-driving cars, autonomous systems, and that's a really big kind of vertical for us right now, where we're literally taking video from the hood, from six different sensors, and we're tagging pedestrians and intersections and everything to really train up those algorithms. I mean, That's the way it works, right? It's not kind of if then else type software code anymore. Most algorithms nowadays are getting trained up, and it's people that are doing that on an ongoing active basis.
So a self-driving car doesn't have software in it that automatically knows what's a pedestrian and what's an intersection. At least it didn't know it until a human being saw a picture of what the car saw and said, that's a person. And if you say that enough, then the software and the car therefore understands anything that looks anything like that is a person. That's how you do it.
Yeah, it's millions of those data points that basically they're allowed. That's you talked about OCR, computer vision. All those technologies are actually first trained with human created output, and so we like to train up those algorithms, but then also sometimes augment and kind of fill in the gap when they can't quite get, you know, the level of accuracy they need.
So you know my interviews, and therefore I don't think you take this the wrong way, but dude, what about Mechanical Turk? Amazon's got tons of these people. What does the world need you for?
Yeah, I mean, they were a big part of the reason we started Cloud Factory. I mean, 10 years ago, Amazon came out with Mechanical Turk really to fill their own need, right? Mm-hmm. There's massive amounts of product listings that need to scrubbed and tagging things so that their search worked better. I mean, all these uses, they did it for themselves and said, hey, let's put it out there for others to use. Unfortunately, I think the world has spoken that kind of this anonymous crowdsourcing is not the future of work. There's a piece of it, and that's the piece that we've captured, right? So having the ability to have an API-driven workforce, send your work to the cloud and have it come back done in minutes, absolutely is part of the future work. But you know, our big thing is the kind of anonymous crowd that has no training, no security, et cetera, versus actually having trained, vetted, managed professionals that are really building up that workforce.
So these people work for you.
We have a combination of independent contractors and full-time people. So it's kind of a hybrid workforce, but they do engage. So you can think more of like Uber, right, where there is more of a direct ability to engage. It's not signing up online, anonymous, you never meet anyone, you know, your account gets blocked, you just create a new account, et cetera, et cetera. So kind of enterprise grade alternative to Mechanical Turk.
Yeah, I don't want to put down Mechanical Turk, but here's a problem that I had with Mechanical Turk. Yeah. I used to have my transcripts done by Mechanical Turk. And if you go back early enough, you'll see that. And I got really good at it. I created this whole system that would take my interviews, chop them up into bite-sized pieces, send it to Mechanical Turk for people to just transcribe a small piece, bid it out, the whole thing. And if you look at some of my past transcripts, you'll see random stuff that people put in there. And I didn't have a system in place to catch it. I kept trying to come up with more systems to catch it. Maybe if I send the same piece to two different people, and if there's a big enough variation, my software will catch it and say, this needs to be looked at by a third person. And then I would send it to a third person. And that's what we're constantly doing with Mechanical Turk. They're good people, inexpensive, but it's hard to depend on it.
It's close, right?
Right.
I mean, and it's the same as AI, actually, right? You think about it, sort of that idea of getting 60%, 70%, 80% kind of accuracy or quality of work is actually kind of useless, right? In most situations, the difference between even 80% and 95, 99% is the difference between having a real usable product, a real usable user experience. And so that's exactly what we've built. Is you learn from, you want it to feel like AI, you want this idea of elastic workforce, global. I mean, all those pieces are there, but it's kind of how you actually create that workforce is really, I think, the different take that we have on it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I always thought maybe I was the one who was at fault. And you're a guy I record these interviews via video. We also turn them into audio, and then we turn them into a transcript. You're a guy who reads the transcripts, who's actually passed the transcripts to people on your team. So you know the value of it. Mm-hmm. For someone like you to see a little bit of a mistake, maybe you could look the other way. But if the whole thing is junky, I look junky because that's your whole interface into me. And that's why I get where you're coming from. Let's talk dollars and cents, though. How big a business is this? What kind of revenues did you guys pull in 2016?
Well, I mean, we're growing real quick right now. I mean, our fiscal year is kind of messed up. But in terms of where we are kind of scale and scope, we're at about a $5 million run rate. You know, we just had a great quarter. We feel like we've hit an inflection point. Mm-hmm. We were about 40% growth last quarter versus the previous quarter. So we've had 10 consistent quarters of growth, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we started building this thing in 2010 and really focused on getting an engineering team, getting a platform.
And we'll get into it. I know you love the details here, and everyone who's listening loves the details, and I want to get into that. But I've got to ask you something that I probably should have asked my college professors back when I was in school.
Yep.
And maybe I didn't. I didn't remember it. What's the deal with companies that have a fiscal year that's different from the regular year? Why not start your
year? There's a reason.
Teach me, please.
Because there's a reason.
You're not the only one.
Yeah. So we are a micro multinational, right? We are, you know, based out of Hong Kong with offices in Nepal, in Kenya, US, and now we're just opening up UK. I just got back 2 days ago. So in certain places, it's just, you know, so Nepal is kind of an offset. So we have a June 30th year end. And so it was kind of triggered by certain places are not on a calendar year.
What do you mean? And Nepal doesn't use the American calendar, but the Christian calendar, is that what it's called?
They don't I don't know what it's called, but it is, it's related to the lunar. Yeah.
Oh, and
it's
so totally they use different. A different calendar.
They use a different
and
calendar.
So you ended up using that.
Yeah. Well, we ended up mapping as close as we could to that. Exactly. So it's just kind of half year shifted off and.
Okay. Yeah. All right. This whole thing in Nepal is you and your wife 2008 went to Nepal to do what?
2008 was a 2 week trip. It was, you know, I'm Canadian. Me and my wife got married in Canada. She got an opportunity to go work in Doha, Qatar in the Middle East. And we said, hey, we don't have kids yet. Let's do it. We can go travel. Let's do it. Big part of that, top of the list, was getting to go to Nepal. So we had the opportunity, 2 week vacation. We'd actually met some really good Nepali friends in Doha. Uh-huh. And so we went back to meet one of our friends' family in the village. And, you know, it was just a beautiful time of seeing. Yeah, it's gorgeous, right? I mean, it's the Himalayas and just it's a gorgeous, gorgeous country. But it was kind of towards the end of that trip that I found myself, you know, in the village, and then the contrast of being in Kathmandu, right? You know, third world, very urban city, where I'm eating pizza in a cafe, talking to a bunch of computer guys. And you know, I started finding out, like, what do you guys do? What do you guys make? Like, mm-hmm. what do you guys know? And I was blown away at the talent, right? I mean, just a little naive. I've, you know, done companies in Canada and the US, and it just was blown away. These guys are super smart. And they were making literally almost nothing. And so it's just like, wait a second, you guys are way too smart to be making that little money. There's something wrong here. And so they wanted to learn Ruby on Rails. I extended my trip for about 3 weeks to bought an iMac. My wife's like, you're going to have to sell the iMac, but you know, it's not a big deal. It was a little bit of money. So it was kind of the cute pet project, she thought at first. And then during that time, people were saying, hey, where are you? I'm like, oh, I'm still in Kathmandu. I'm training up these guys on Rails. And they're like, what? You've got Rails? Those are like unicorns. Like, can you do a project? And I was like, how much?
Because you trained these people. So they said, can they work for us?
Yeah.
But wait,
yeah.
Hang on, Mark. They've been trained for days, not weeks, not years, really. And they're ready to be hired by your friends?
Not at all. But, you know, that's how businesses start, right?
I see. So they didn't assume that these guys were as good as DHH. They just said, hey, you know what? You got people who can do this. How about you train them up and we hire them?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think our first project was literally at like $5 an hour. So it was like $5 an hour, $10 an hour.
What were you doing at $5, $10 an hour? What kind of coding work?
I don't know. It was a couple of web apps to start. Yeah. I mean, it was very small projects, but the idea was it was paid work, right? It was paid work and it allowed us to kind of pay to train and start growing a team. And, you know, we grew to probably about 12, 16 engineers. Mm-hmm. And really it was a software outsourcing boutique, right? Ruby on Rails, building MVPs.
And when you talk about $5 an hour, we're talking about an environment. You told our producer that you had your first meal there in an open area. And could you describe what you saw and what this whole buffalo thing was there?
Yeah, that was one of those just like moments where you can like remember the literal, like the smell and the senses, right? Mm-hmm. So it was actually back during that first 2 weeks where we were out in the village, right? Like very, very, very poor. And it was my good friend and I'm at his family's home and they had prepared a meal and we're literally eating outside right by the two massive water buffalo, right, that they have. And, you know, they give the plate and it's like, I'm the guest, so I eat. They had to like go to their neighbor to borrow a chicken because, you know, I'm a guest, important guest. And so I'm sitting there eating this rice and lentils and, you know, and there's flies everywhere and there's just like the buffalo crabs right there. And I'm literally like started shaking because I'm like trying not to cry, like thinking like I'm going to die. And it was just that moment of being like the naive Westerner, right, that has no idea. And you're like, wow, I really want to see like how I could help, but I feel so helpless. You know, I mean, I'm a computer geek. What can I possibly do to, you know, to like, this is not, you know, it just, there was just such a visceral kind of feeling. And so it was kind of from that moment to then being in Kathmandu and realizing like, oh my goodness, these guys are asking about Rails and, you know, contracts and all these things. Like I actually know something. I can actually add some value, right? And so that really was just that contrast, right? Of like, hey, you know what? Maybe I can't help teach somebody, you know, how to grow things better in the village. But you know what? There's a lot of really smart, talented people. And if there's something that, you know, I've received a lot of opportunities, if I can, you know, give some opportunities back, let's do it. So it ended up being that project, a second project. We ended up, you know, staying there, living, you know, me and my wife had our two kids and, you know, so two kids, Cloud Factory.
You ended up having
your two kids in Nepal. Well, they grew up there. We lived there for 6 years.
Wow. Yeah. You know what? I told you before we started, your Skype showed that you were in Nepal. Like you were so connected to Nepal that when I look you up, you're the Nepalese guy.
Yeah. It's home for us, right? I mean, we've been here helping get the sales and marketing office into orbit, but I mean –
And the you know, and here meaning you're back in the U.S. What city?
We're in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina.
Okay, and the reason that you had this experience is that you were an entrepreneur before. Is the company before this the one where you went to Java One conference and you did the whole? You know what? Which one is that? Is that Godspeed Computing or is that Sprout Technology?
No, that was actually Zucato. So I came out of, you know, computer science, was working for Sun Microsystems, and mm-hmm. the manager there started a company. And that was probably my 2 years, 2.5 years of just
2000 to 2002.
Yeah, something like that.
So what did you do in those 2 years? Well, tell me actually just – I think this story about Java One conference will give us a sense of what was going on there.
It will.
At the time.
It was a typical – you know, I mean, we were – I was the – you know – there's five people in a room. We grew to 140 in like 14 months and opened up offices all over. And it was a, you know, Bluetooth, wireless Bluetooth. So we actually like a native Bluetooth and Java, like actually in hardware kind of thing. And, you know, I was, you know, in product at the time and had the opportunity to do this keynote at Java One. And so I, you know, just had too much money, too young. And I bought this like $3,000 massive blimp. And we were going to put our like technology and have it like come over the crowd and like, you know, and it gets close and the Bluetooth connects and all these things are going to happen. It was this beautiful scripted dramatic thing until the fire marshal, you know, reviewed the fact that there's actually flammable combustible gas inside the blimp. And so that demo didn't go. I think we literally flew the blimp once, and it was just, you know, those
you
again,
already had bought it at the time, but you know what?
Oh yeah.
I'm impressed that you would even think of that. That is really dramatic. But at the same time, we're talking about after 2000, after the dot-com market crash, it's a really hard time to spend that kind of money. You're much more careful with your money now. You saw this opportunity, right? And you said, you told our producer, look, I found developers get 6,000 rupees per month, which is the equivalent of $60 a month. And so you said, look, there's an opportunity here. These people want more opportunities. The fact that they don't live in the US shouldn't hold them back. Let's find a way to teach them. Let's find a way to bring them into the market in the US. And let's find a way to open up the eyes of Americans and people in the rest of the world to the possibility here. You were starting to train them. You told us that you got to about a dozen people. You are now a tech firm, essentially, right? Now that at least at this point in the story, meanwhile, today you're not doing that. You're doing simpler tasks.
Yep.
What was the period? What allowed you to say, you know what? I have all these developers. The world is aching for developers, but I'm going to shift them towards this simpler task.
So it was 2009. We've been doing this for about a year, year and a half. And what happened was all of the customers we were building MVPs for were asking for us to do data work, right? They're like, hey, can you, you know, research all this data on financial aid organizations in the US? Can you, you know, watch this video and tag every time somebody scores a goal or gets in a fight, right? It was a, you know, NHL amateur hockey video. So all these different things, right, were very routine, repetitive work. And so we started actually as the developers trying to use things like Mechanical Turk and other options out there. We're like, wow, this sucks. Like, this is not going to, like, we can't do this. And so at the same time, so we saw the demand from the market, right? Everyone who's building software needs data, like, to make their business model work. And at first I'm like, hey, we don't do your data crap work. Like, we are a high-end Ruby on Rails boutique, right? But at the same time, on the other side, we're living in Nepal and we're hiring these engineers, but I'm meeting literally, like, my wife, you know, is going to buy vegetables in the market every day. And there's people like, you guys have a business, you must hire me. And people from the UK, people that have massive education, super, super smart, and just like 40 to 60% unemployment, like literally like so many people that are idle. And so yeah, the whole thing, the thesis for the business is that talent is equally distributed around the world, but opportunities are not. So how do we use technology to really flatten the world? Because we talk about the world is flat, but it's not yet. It's flattening quickly, but it absolutely takes a lot of innovation and technology and different models to really connect growing businesses to, you know, this global talent. Like, how do you do that at scale? And so, yeah, that's where we really pivoted. We're like, there's a demand, there's a supply. What's in the market right now is fundamentally broken in terms of the thesis of how they do their workforce model. And so, you know, that was the opportunity. And we pivoted in 2010, started, you know, everyone that was on the bench that wasn't billable started building, you know, for version one of the platform. And,
building the platform first and then doing the tasks.
Yeah, yeah. It was all about, like, you know, 2008 to 2010 was building the engineering team. And then 2010 to 2012 was building the platform. We launched at TechCrunch Disrupt about 2012. Mm-hmm. And we hired our first 25 cloud workers. We call them cloud workers. We put them in teams of five. We're kind of learning from, like, the Grameen model, right? The whole microfinance, like, solidarity of, like, how do you loan to people and actually get really high payments. And it's, you put them in teams and you get this idea of solidarity. So you loan to a team and the whole team has to pay back. And so we built this team-based model and we're learning how to, you know, to motivate people. So you go from being a tech company with a bunch of engineers to actually now, like, I'm reading about behavioral psychology and organizational, you know, breaking out my old textbooks, right, that I thought I would never actually need again. And so that was kind of 2012 to 2014.
Well, before you go beyond that, then, I've got a bunch of notes here. I've got notes to ask you about what was in the platform, about what you learned about behavioral psychology. I also want to find out about this thing that you did. We talked about Mechanical Turk and how you you have better quality results than they do. But still, there was this interesting thing that happened with Mechanical Turk in 2010 that I want to ask you about. But first, I've got to tell people about my sponsor, which is ActiveCampaign. The reason I have to tell them about it is this. Look, right now, what many people do, Mark, with email is they send the same email to every single person on their list, regardless of what country they're in, what time zone they're in, what they did. Did they buy or not buy? Did they click a link or not click a link? That is a huge insult to your audience, and it also is a wasted opportunity for a business. And so ActiveCampaign has come out with a product that says, look, we'll let you add people to your mailing list on ActiveCampaign, but we will enable you to actually talk to them intelligently. So if somebody has bought, you could send a different message to them. If somebody has clicked the link and another, you send them a different message from someone who's never clicked the link. And based on what they clicked, you could decide what goes into the message. If you write one email to everybody, maybe the PS line could be different for buyers and non-buyers, for people interested in one segment of your business and not another. That is dramatically impactful for business sales. They do some really cool things too. They allow you to A/B test emails with that. If you just collect an email address from someone, they could fetch the person's age, their gender, their location, social interests, social profiles, all this stuff. I mean, we're talking about really sophisticated software that they are paying me to talk about for one reason only. People don't realize how powerful ActiveCampaign is because ActiveCampaign is so simple. And a lot of these features are new and integrated into their software, and people who've been marketing for years don't recognize these features exist and that these features exist in ActiveCampaign. And I really want you, if you're listening to me, to go check out ActiveCampaign. They're going to help grow your sales by making your email marketing much more intelligent. We're talking about, as I said, based on what people have done on your site, every interaction that you have with them can change. If you're listening to me, they've got a special offer. They're going to give you your second month for free. They're going to give you 2 one-on-one sessions with their people. So you actually get to work with the consultant to help think through and strategize your email marketing strategy. And they will even migrate you. So if you're with another software and you're not happy with them, they will migrate you over for free, which is, frankly, it's fairly easy for you to do on your own, but the fact that they're going to do it for you is going to help make that transition a lot easier for you. They've got so many other things that I could tell you about, like CRM. They have a workflow to enable your team to sell. I could go on and on and on with the list of features, but what I want to emphasize is this one thing. If you're emailing your customers, you want to email them more intelligently, and ActiveCampaign will allow you to do that and do it in a way that's so simple that even your new virtual assistant without much training will be able to maintain your email communications. For the rest, all the other features, you can just go to this special URL where they're giving Mixergy listeners an unbelievable offer that they're not giving anyone else. The URL is, write this down because you're going to need it for somebody else, if not for you right now. And frankly, you should check it out yourself too. It's ActiveCampaign.com/Mixergy. ActiveCampaign.com/Mixergy. Really get to know ActiveCampaign. This little flowchart that they have on the middle right of their page will show you how helpful they could be to your business. All right, ActiveCampaign.com/Mixergy. Mark, the platform. What do you mean by that? I kind of, as I was going through your service, I was trying to peek in and see what your team sees when somebody submits this task, but I don't think I fully got it. Can you describe what the platform looked like version one?
Version one was really, really about, how do you provide an API to clients so that they can send tasks into a system. And then how do you get those system? How do you get that routed to the right worker at the right time? And then how do you then get those results back? So it really was more about how do we just get, a very tech driven, so we know where every task is at every time, and it's just an API driven workforce. So
when you say to the right worker at the right time, do you mean if they're actually sitting at their desk and don't have a lot of other projects, you want to route it to them? If they are not there because they're at home that day, you don't want to send it to them. That's basic stuff, right?
Yeah, well, that's really where we start to evolve, right? Was more of, okay, well, the right worker is about who has the right skills, right? Mm-hmm. So it was really this idea of, okay, we've got tasks on one side and you've got workers on the other, and tasks are coming in and you see who's online, who has the right skill set, who has the right skill score. Do you want to send it to the best workers that are available? And then there's a lot of it is definitely around like deadline driven turnaround time. And so if you've got 5 hours to do a task, you're going to put a lower priority than if you have to get something back in 5 minutes. And so kind of the right work at the right time, kind of that real time matching and dispatching of tasks was, a key part of the technology that
you talk about. Grameen Bank wanting to create teams of people who then get to borrow. And I understand it because the borrowers have no connection to the lender. And so why would they want to repay? Where's the obligation? But if they have a team of people, they don't want to disappoint the rest of the team by not repaying their loans. And then it looks bad for the team. When in that context, it makes sense. But in your context, I'm not fully understanding it. Why can't they just be responsible to the software? And if they don't do their work, then you guys let them go. Or before then, they get an alert saying, hey, we've assigned you this many tasks. You're not completing them, or you're not completing them right. You're considered yourself warned.
Yeah, I think we take two approaches. Like, one is definitely using software and data and algorithms to know and measure how each worker is doing, right? Like, that's absolutely essential. But if all you're doing is just kind of policing, right, you're missing out, right? So that's exactly where we come in, is saying, okay, we want to actually motivate and equip and train and invest and really have workers fired up to do great work. So when they sit down to do a 1 minute task, the level of ownership and care and pride that they have in doing that work is the difference between 95% and 99%, which is the difference between us beating every competitor in the world at this, right? So for us, it's that solidarity. So we've got team leaderboards, right? Every week, you know where your team is. And when you get together, there's a weekly meeting. So everyone gets together. They work remotely. About 80% of our workforce is distributed, or we say semi-distributed. But then they come together and they meet together with in person with one of our representatives. And so you literally get that effect, right, of looking, okay, like, dude, you, what are you doing last week? You're killing us, right? Like, we fell from 134 as a team, right? So there's motivations from that perspective. And there's just, it's just the whole, who's my tribe, right? It's like, what's the future of these gigs look like if we're all freelancers that sit at home and don't have any social contact, right? Like, a job is more than a paycheck. And so we've been trying to design something where these people are like friends. We've got people that are getting married, that have been meeting through the company, so there's lifelong friendships and other things that form when you put people together in groups. And, we have them go out and do community service projects, and we do like kind of leadership stuff. And so it's like, how do you really design, the future work from home kind of thing, right? So like, I see. We want to be the best gig in town. Wherever we operate, that's Nepal, Kenya, et cetera.
Huh. I wonder what else this team approach could actually work for. I'm imagining even online education would work better that way, that it's not you interacting with the site, it's you and your team interacting, and who finishes and who doesn't determines who finishes an assignment or not determines how many points you get. How do you guys score people? You have so many different kinds of tasks. How do you assign points?
Yeah, well, there's lots of different ways, right? I mean, typically within our platform, we're doing things like sending them known answers or gold standard. So, periodically our algorithm will send you a question that already knows the answer to really test how much does it trust you. And so we've got a reputation algorithm that, does certain things like that, or sends your work to a more senior worker for kind of a review, and all these different signals that we get that allow us to give you kind of calculate a score. Which is a skill score, but essentially it's how much does our system trust you with these particular tasks? And so that's one aspect. The other aspect now is we've actually brought it up a whole new level, because a lot of our clients are having, they're spinning up what we call a work stream, which is basically a remote team, like spinning up a server on AWS. You're spinning up a team, as a work stream, and they're having our workers work on their platforms. And so we're not just people sending us tasks. We actually have our workers now logging in, working right on a lot of our platforms. So, but that work doesn't flow through us. And so we needed to find a way, how do we keep our reputation algorithms going? And so we actually created a browser. So the WorkStream browser is something that are all of our cloud workers use now. And so it's just based on Chrome, based on Chromium. And we put some software in that actually literally looks at their keystrokes and looks at their mouse usage, and even turning on the webcam, looking at posture and engagement and facial stuff, like really simple signals that actually allow us to measure the engagement and the quality.
But you see
of
engagement that way. You can't tell if somebody's in my system and entering correct information or not. You just know that they're fully entering information, right? Is there any feedback mechanism to tell you this worker did the job right versus this worker did it diligently?
But well, Yeah, so we have that, and that's exactly, you talk about kind of like training, right? That's how we train our algorithms, is we know the workers that do really good work. We have all the results, and then we look at our best profile workers, and that's how we then train our algorithms to detect kind of the signals and the patterns that really indicate when people are doing good work.
I see. So you can't, if someone's logging into someone else's website, you can't get that feedback mechanism that says this specific task was done right, but you can tell if this worker has all the traits of somebody who does it right. And I see.
It's even early indications are that it actually can even be a better way to really understand how well people are working. And
really?
And absolutely.
It's surprising. If someone's coming into my site and entering a transcript into my site, not yours, mm-hmm. isn't the best way to know whether it's done right to actually look at the result or to see if I as the customer have kicked it back?
Yes, that would be the best way. But the problem, right, is all you can really do is a random sample. So it's when you're doing literally millions of tasks every day, you can't look at the results of every single one. And so typically what people do and what we do is you take a random sample of those, and that allows you to estimate the level of accuracy. So if there's 100,000 transcripts going through in a day, right, we're going to look at a small percentage and guesstimate, right, how overall it's doing. But actually being able to track every single signal actually allows us not just to estimate and measure accuracy, but to really get granular and to understand which workers and, are mapped to which transcript. And so it's just a different thing. The most power, right, is of course when you put the two together, right? So you kind of capture this reputation signals, how much do you trust workers, quality, you know, at the browser level. And you also have knowledge of the actual work and some of the other mechanisms we have. So you put those two things together, and that's what we're having fun. It's a never ending thing, right? I mean, that's the technology of just managing a workforce at scale. You know, we get to build a jet engine because we have, you know, you talked about building your own thing on top of Mechanical Turk, right? And that's what a lot of people do, but it's great when we can take kind of that consolidated investment and just really focus on solving that problem. Like that's what we get to solve for our customers.
Right. I shouldn't have to figure out how to do that on Mechanical Turk. That's not my business. My business is doing interviews. My business is selling courses. My business is not on figuring out how to outsmart Turkers all over the world.
Exactly.
Behavioral psychology. Can you teach me one thing that you learned about behavioral psychology that's had a big impact on you?
Oh, it's a good question. The first thing that came to mind is actually related back to the whole team thing. And, you know, we did find out through, you know, our data scientists came back because we had certain teams that were outperforming other teams, and we weren't sure why that was. And then all of a sudden we found what the correlation was. The correlation was that there was an existing social relationship between the workers before they came. So we had people that came in, we just put them in their own team. We had other people that came in and said, hey, like, these are my buddies from college, right? Or, hey, can like my mom and my aunt and my neighbor work with me? And so we found that actually when you have some existing social relationship within that team, it actually does change the behavior. So they were saying that they were more satisfied, you know, when we did, you know, surveys in terms of like engagement. So they're more happy, their results are better. And it's definitely a combination of using data to measure it, but then to really understand, okay, what is the behavior psychology that's driving this team dynamic, this individual dynamic, and how do we, you know, adjust our model and our technology to maximize that?
You built from 2010 to 2012, and even though Mechanical Turk is essentially a competitor, you guys built your platform on top of Mechanical Turk.
Yeah,
initially. How? What was the connection there?
So we just, you know, you had to focus on one problem at a time, right? It was just, for us, it was building the technology, but we didn't have workers, right? So initially, our whole purpose was to try and create meaningful work for people in the developing world and really make this flat world a reality. But we had to start with getting a working platform. And so we actually were sending all of our work initially to MTurk, you know, just to really get things working. And also
you were Turkers on Mechanical Turk's platform.
No, actually, we were sending our work to Mechanical Turkers.
And you were hiring them.
Exactly, yeah.
Why hire them when you had so many local people who are looking for work?
Initially, it was just, again, because we were a bunch of engineers that were just focused on the tech. Mm-hmm. And then secondarily, it's like that transition because, you know, we had 25 workers, and then you have 50 workers, and you have 200 workers, but then all of the overflow would kind of be able to go. So we could take work from our customers, and we do all of the work as much as we can, and then we send the excess overflow to Mechanical Turk. So there's a bit of a transition period until we could get a critical mass and
I see.
Get into orbit.
I remember Matt Morales.
Yeah.
Was a guy who I'd known for a while. He was a Mixergy fan. He told me he was building something that would transcribe my interviews. And at the time, I wasn't making money with the interviews. So I didn't want to spend a lot of money on transcriptions. But I loved what he was doing. It was called Speaker Text, right?
Yep.
And the beautiful part about Speaker Text, he had this great example on the website where I could not just watch a video and read the transcript, but the transcript would scroll with the video. And if I tapped any section of the transcript, it would go to that section of the video, right? This whole interaction was beautiful. I'm only bringing that up because early on, you guys acquired his company, and I can't figure out why. What was the connection? What did you need?
Yeah, it's a great question. So yeah, Matt and a great team of engineers, they built a couple key tech assets, right? So they raised from Google Ventures, a bunch of other people. And so they started with speaker text, like you said, but then they started building a more generalized technology, right? Similar to our platform. And yeah, we found out a little bit what they built and got very, very interested. And so, yeah, we did the acquisition really for their tech assets. And so we took their technology, we took our version one of the platform, and we actually put them together for
their Cloud software? Factory
version two. Yeah, their software. They had some, they did some really good
like
things.
What?
They had
give me an example, because the guy looks like a fun-loving guy. He's always a hangout guy. If I just wanted to talk real with someone and also have a good time, he would be one of the guys that I would go to.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't Matt.
We never got to the business part of it. What did he build that was so exciting?
Well, that was a problem. I mean, I think real frankly, I mean, they didn't know how to monetize it. And, you know, there's a lot of other things going on as there always is in startups.
Yep.
But you know, they had some guys out of Carnegie Mellon that really built some really cool things. So we talked about that idea of the reputation algorithm. Mm-hmm. We talked about that task dispatching. And they had some very interesting technology that, you know, just kind of, it was like a perfect puzzle piece with what we had built. So we built a lot of great technology to manage the workforce and do some similar things. But we just saw those two puzzle pieces and we put them together. And that was version two of our platform. So, yeah, no, yeah, they're great guys. They built some great tech. And
now Matt owns a piece of your business.
No, it was actually, it was just a straight up acquisition.
Cash. Mm-hmm. Wow. How much cash did you guys raise? How much did you raise?
We've raised about $7 million to date. Wow. We're just closing a Series B, hopefully in the next few weeks.
What was the first one and who was it from?
We did 500K was our seed round. Ended up getting an extra couple hundred K from a private equity firm actually here in North Carolina, Research Triangle Park. It's called Sovereigns Capital. It was a small fund, micro fund. I think their first one was $12 million. This one's $50 million, and we were their first investment. I mean, we were at a great – I mean, our costs have always been obviously low. I mean, we started the company in Nepal. That's where 80-plus percent of our employees are. Like, it's not – we're not outsourcing to them. They, if anything, they're outsourcing to, like, our sales and marketing to the U.S. right now. And so that's
– What do you mean they're – who's outsourcing your sales and marketing?
Well, I think a lot of people always think, like, they assume when you have offshore offices, right? That it's like, it's, you know, the US outsourcing there. And it's a kind of this weird thing where no, like we've started the company, we've got people from different countries that, you know, that have moved and are living in Kathmandu, Nepal. So that really is our headquarters. And we've, you know, so we've, the last office and the smallest office has been our sales office. And so we've actually kind of outsourced sales and marketing, you know, to
I see.
To
You're saying, look, we're essentially an international company that's outside the U.S. It's not like we're a U.S. company that hired these guys outside to work for us. It's an international company that happens to have sales and marketing here in the U.S.
Yeah.
By the way, you mentioned your low cost. So I'm on your pricing page, cloudfactory.com/pricing, which,
yep.
Dude, the little thing on the left that I can click on with my mouse and move around with all the people, I can't stop playing with that. But the thing that stands out for me is I thought you guys would be super cheap. You're not. You're at every level. You're, I think, above – almost every level you are above minimum wage in the U.S.
Well, I mean, usually what you'll see is we're about $5 to $8 an hour is kind of the range that you'll see based on volume. So that $5 to $8 an hour is, you know, that's everything in, right? That's project management. That's client success. That's – training. I mean, everything is included, you know, in that. So,
and if I ask someone to transcribe a receipt today, and the receipt takes them just 2 minutes, and they don't do anything else tomorrow. They don't do anything else today or tomorrow. Do you round up to the nearest 5 minutes or the nearest hour or anything?
No, absolutely not. Yeah. So we do subscriptions that are basically subscribing to a block of hours, which is I think what you're looking at right now.
I see,
but then we also do, you know, it's like anything, right? That's kind of the starting point, right? I mean, a lot of our customers have grown much beyond kind of what's on the public pricing, and they actually subscribe to a block of units. So unit is actually a pay for result. So when we get into a larger contract, we're processing millions of receipts, for instance, they're subscribing to, you know, a million receipts
basis,
a month.
And not per receipt, minute.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's X cents per receipt. And but even in that hourly model, I mean, no, that is captured, you know, like everything. It's to the minute. Okay. Yeah. To the second.
Your first batch of clients were people who came to you saying, can you do this for us? Can you go beyond coding? And that's where you got them, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Before we go into the next batch of customers, and I want to talk about customer, about sales and marketing, I have to tell people about TopTal. And you know TopTal. You guys have actually written an ebook, I think, about them, you said?
Yeah, they were involved in one of our kind of on-demand economy type books, yeah.
The thing about TopTal is that they recognize that there are some people who just want to be fantastic developers, want to be tested, and they want to focus on like that top 3% of people. What most people don't understand about TopTal, Mark, is this, that there are a lot of development shops, a lot of creative shops, a lot of agencies out there that if you call them up and you say, hey, can you do an iPhone app for me? Say, yeah. And they actually have an iPhone developer there. And if you say, can you do an Android developer for me, for example, they'll say, yeah, we have a developer for it. And they'll sign your contract, but they actually don't have an Android developer. They only focus on iOS. For the Android developer, their secret is they go to TopTal and they say, here's the project we have. Here's who's on our team. We need somebody or a team of people to just work on this project to hit our numbers and to hit our deadlines. And then TopTal sends them the developers. For many agencies, TopTal is that secret weapon, that secret sauce that allows them to act bigger, to sell more, but be so lean that they only have an operation of, in some cases, it's literally two or three people, but they could then take on many bigger projects. That's what many of the companies that if you're listening to me, if you're hiring companies, there's a very good chance that they are using TopTal to beef up their team. And I had no idea this was going on until I had a conversation with someone at TopTal. And his whole job was to interact with agencies like this and to be the point person for them because there's so many who are doing it. So if you're out there and you're looking to hire a developer to help grow your project, to focus on something, and you don't have the team to do it, you might as well cut out the middleman in some cases. Just go straight to TopTal. The cool thing about TopTal is you don't just go on their website and sign up. You actually go to their website and schedule a call with a real person. You tell them what you're working on. You tell them how you like to work. You tell them a little bit about your culture, frankly. And what the output needs to be. Is it a long-term project, short-term project, whatever? I had them just do search. I said, look, here's the thing. Search is driving us crazy. We can't get out of our own heads about it. Can you bring somebody who can think differently about it and can help us rethink it? They gave us someone. We said, it's a good fit, but I don't think it's perfect. They brought us someone else. We hired them. Perfect fit within, I thought it would be a few weeks. It ended up being a few days. The person redid our whole search top to bottom beautifully. That's the kind of thing that you could do to TopTal. You talk to them. They match you up. If it's a good fit, you can often start working with them within days. If you're listening to me, they are going to give you something they're giving nobody else. And that's because the founders of TopTal are long-term Mixergy fans and they want to support what we're doing here at Mixergy. They got a lot out of it. They know you're getting a lot out of it and they want to support what you're working on. And so here's what they're giving Mixergy listeners only at a special URL just for us. You're going to get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. So if you're listening to me and you need this or you know someone who needs it, please refer them to the special URL. And it is toptal.com/Mixergy. Top is in top of the mountain. Tal is in talent.com/Mixergy. And I shouldn't have to say this because you're listening to me, but Mixergy is spelled M-I-X-E-R-G-Y. I had somebody complain to me yesterday that I got it wrong and I want to correct it. M-I-X-E-R-G-Y. Mark, how did you get your next batch of customers when it was time for you to actually go out and bring them in? Oh, you're still on mute. I know you were muting when, so you wouldn't cough into the mic as I was doing that spot.
Yeah. No, thank you. We, you can picture me, a technology founder, sitting there in Kathmandu, Nepal, trying to sell over Skype, right? So it wasn't easy, but that's reality, right? When you're getting going. So it's like the first wave is your network. Mm-hmm. The second wave, it was just scrappy, just trying to find different companies that were fast growing that, we did different things like looking at people using Mechanical Turk that were unhappy.
How? Wish you would have called me. I had no idea this was even possible back then.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it was totally not scalable. Like it always is when you get your first wave before you kind of hire sales. And, it's looking around online, we're able to find some people that are using Mechanical Turk, looking at forums, people that are unhappy, just
find. So yeah. That helped you do it. What else did you do to figure out who could potentially want to work with you?
I think it really moved, it felt early on, it was a little bit more like a needle in a haystack because you have to find exactly the use case. And what we found was actually just starting to have conversations with venture-backed startups. You realize that, man, they're just looking for a better way to get this work done, right? Like I need an easier way to get routine repetitive work done. They've rather tried outsourcing it, crowdsourcing, hiring interns, freelancers. They tried all these different things that aren't working. And so we started having conversations and being like, hey, what could you do with thousands of college educated people on the other end of a browser, right? Like you guys are growing. You've got tons of routine repetitive. Everyone's got, routine repetitive work. And so it was in the midst of those conversations that we just started to get like, yeah, like we need something to do this. We need something to do that. And so it really was more of a inbound conversation, like here's use cases, could you guys do this? And we started doing more and more of them. We started building more tech and getting trained workers and just got better and better. And so we've been going a little bit after different, we call kind of micro markets, right? So processing millions of receipts, millions of invoices, we're tagging tons of images for self-driving cars, autonomous systems, where do all these different kind of things where we've gotten really good at kind of dominating one by one. The way we've done that is just by having conversations with mostly tech companies that are growing. And just like you mentioned, TopTal, right, is a lot of people are using companies like TopTal to called agile talent, right? Like how do we, focus our core strategic work and then augment that, with these types of on-demand online work companies. And so I'm going to get some developers from TopTal. I'm going to, kind of scale up kind of the operations and data work, with Cloud Factory. And so, yeah, it's just... Yeah, it's been kind of that process.
A lot of the conversations were just you saying, look, I have all these smart people. They could do work for you. What kind of work do you have that's repetitive tasks that we can assign to them? And they were brainstorming with you. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
How did you get these people to be willing to brainstorm with you? You're talking about venture-backed companies. They have to move fast. They have to grow quickly. They have no time to brainstorm with anyone. Why you? How did you get them to do that?
They've got time. They do have time because this is the work that everyone's trying to get off their plate, right? So they can focus, like you said, on their core. Like, how do I innovate? How do I grow? Well, you've got just massive stuff. So like, I want to sell. Well, I've got tons of data that I need to get enriched and clean, right? Like, and so it's actually amazing that it's a big problem. It's a big problem for fast growing companies. Is I've got tons of stuff that needs to get done and there's no good way to do it. And so it was amazing that people are really willing to listen and give things a try, right? And that's really what's happened. There is a lot of people, we make it really easy to get going, right? Spin up a work stream, get going right away. As little as 200 hours a month is like $1,800 a month. So it's like I could hire a full-time employee or I can subscribe to Cloud Factory and get people starting to do some stuff. And if it works, my business process. And so it was all about like removing the barriers, reducing friction, getting people going, getting them trying different use cases. It's been that rinse and repeat. I mean, we're at a different place now, but that's really, how it started because it was, like finding exactly who may be doing a perfect task. Like that's a needle in a haystack. We just went to who are our early adopters? Who are the people that are just looking for a better way to get this work done? They okay. don't want to do old school outsourcing. They don't want to, they tried Mechanical Turk and it failed. And that's actually been a majority of the venture-backed startups we talked to.
I love that when you talk to our producers, they take these notes and they just feed them to me. And here's one thing that they wrote from your conversation with our producer. Strategic shift happened when you went to Kenya, you locked yourself in a room and you went through all your customers. What was going on there?
You know, for as a founder, that was one of those crazy moments where I feel like I'm always going into the meetings and you have to have like a plan, right? Even with your own like leadership team, it's like, I have to have a plan. And I went in with a plan and we literally came out with something completely different that I never thought of. And I had this like physical, like I was like shaking and sweating. It was crazy because, you know, I would never use the word pivot because that would be way too strong, but it was a really big strategic shift for us. And
from where to where? Where were you before and what happened after that?
So a year ago, if you were a Cloud Factory customer, you were using our platform. So you were taking, if you built it on Mechanical Turk, if you built your own tools, whatever it was, you were going to have to rebuild on top of Cloud Factory's platform. Mm-hmm. And so as the technology founder, I'm like, dude, we've built the best like jet engine. Like, why would anyone build their own thing? It's ridiculous. Like, we've built the best mousetrap. It's unbelievable.
Right.
And everyone was like, oh yeah, that's great. But when you've invested so much, like even you said, right, you invest so much to get things working on a particular platform, you know, the cost and time and risk and everything to move was really hard. And so we had a lot of people like, I love you guys. Like, we need an on-demand workforce, but we actually don't need your tools. We don't need your platform. And so we started experimenting because, I mean, we lost a couple really big deals, like really big deals. And I felt like, you know, I'm the CEO and how did we just lose, you know, top five tech company who loved us, wanted to, you know, access our workforce, but didn't want to do it through our platform. And so we started just iterating with some trials. And so we sat there, you know, in Kenya, you know, everyone coming from Nepal, US, Kenya, executive team, strategic planning. And we came out the other end looking at the data and saying, oh my goodness, this thing is exploding. And the sales team is saying, we need to shift. And so now customers, you know, some of them are taking advantage of our platform, especially if they're just getting started, if they have high volume and efficiency is the most important thing. But a lot of people are just getting going with a work stream and subscribing to a block of hours to have people come and work in Google spreadsheets, work in their platform, whatever that is, right? And we realize just fundamentally, it's like, who are we? Like, are we selling a platform? What are we selling? And so for us, it's like, we're building the world's workforce. We see this like cloud computing is cloud labor. So AWS goes to strategic locations, builds these low-cost data centers in low-cost areas. They put virtualization software to basically rent out slices to the world. We're doing the same thing. And we realize like that's what we do. Our businesses, our workforces are our data centers and our software. And so
people. And that's why I like even on your website, you say spin up a team of people or some variation of it. And this explains why when I always use SimilarWeb to kind of hunt through people's traffic to see what's going on. A lot of your traffic comes from one login. And now I understand why. What seems to happen is you guys use one login to enable your team of people to access your clients' websites without handing over a username and password that you can't revoke.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's really important in terms of, again, security, right? It's a really big thing for us. And
I see.
And so for us to be able to ensure that we know exactly every worker, how they're accessing, what they're accessing, being able to turn that off. It's been important for us. But yeah, that's exactly it.
What if it's not repetitive tasks? What if I have here at Mixergy, like I want to do research on every customer and it's not a repetitive, it's a research-based task. Is that something you guys do?
It is. And that was a part of the shift, right? Is we basically have opened up the ability to subscribe to the number of hours. And, you know, we've got kind of a Slack-like channel type system. So you're directly connected to your team and you're able to drive that team, you know, kind of Trello board and Slack. And so we do have people, we kind of call it repetitive and routine. So routine, you know, it's still, you know, in terms of skill base, right? Like we're not doing programming and graphic design and a lot of higher level skill stuff, but yeah, things like research and kind of one-off projects. So we have clients that are driving their remote teams on a day-to-day basis and changing their priorities. And so it's not always just sort of click, 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 like doing, you know, millions of the same task.
Yeah. But it could be like here's the new set of customers. I need this information on them. Give me their Twitter accounts, their Facebook account. More importantly, tell me what school they went to, what they like, what business. I got it. Okay.
Yep.
You mentioned Kenya. I've never met like a guy who's been to so many countries who's running your business. Just every time you talk, it feels like there's another country. You've got the UK, you got the US where you're talking to me from right now. You meet in Kenya, you start in Nepal. Cultural intelligence is an issue and you've had issues with it before, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What's this one example about family doing harvest? Because I don't even understand it, and I understand that you've had an issue with this.
Yeah. So cultural intelligence is one of our six core values. Just the reality of working across different cultures like we do, it's just super, super important. And so for me, you know, again, a young Canadian guy trying to learn how to live in Nepal, you know, it was just time after time of sticking my foot in my mouth and just not understanding. And, you know, I think the time that I was talking about was, you know, a stand-up meeting early on where I wanted to celebrate one of our employees because I thought he was doing a really cool thing, right? So I was like so-and-so is actually taking a couple days off this week, so he won't be in. And, you know, he's actually going to be helping out his family with harvest. And so I was like, that's awesome, right? Like we want to, you know, that's a good value. Like, hey, like they're using their vacation, not selfishly, but they're actually going to help their family. Like, that's really cool. And so I thought it was a great thing until he came up at the end of the day to my desk and quit and was crying because I had shamed and offended, you know, him because the idea that he wasn't able to hire people to help the family was embarrassing.
It's like
a known sign that if you have to do that yourself, that it's, and so I just had no idea. And so, you know, I had like shamed him in front of the whole office and, you know, it was just, I mean,
what can you do about that? How can you possibly know all this stuff? And the more countries you get into, the harder it is. What do you do about that?
Well, cultural intelligence is, you know, just like emotional intelligence, it's something you really can develop. And that's something we do spend a lot of time, you know, more than the average startup for sure, spending time on. And you can. And there, you know, it's
how?
Things like.
How do you do that? How do you train someone to know that this is a problem that this, I would never know?
Well, there's always going to be mistakes, right? I mean, exactly. Like it's like anything, learning how to ride a bike. I mean, you're going to fall off. Like it's going to happen, but you want to try and reduce the amount of times you fall off. And so, yeah, I mean,
how do you do it?
A lot of it, right, is just, again, is curiosity, right? We really, so, you know, we share different meals, right? So we'll take like a Nepali meal will be served literally in all of our offices, or a Kenyan meal will be served in all of our offices. And we celebrate different holidays and we share stuff back and forth, right?
See.
And you know, we just have open conversations. We actually, again, that team model for our cloud workers, we actually do that internally. And so we go through different kind of leadership and character principles and things like this kind of come up. And so we talk just a lot about the differences and just force people to rub up against each other. And all of a sudden, you know, we're all learning. And I mean, for me, it's like one of the best things about what we've been doing for the last year. I mean, it's changed my life, my family's life. You know, it's amazing. It's, you know, certain people love it, right? Certain people, you know, just, it's the last thing they want to do is get on another plane, learn another language, learn another culture. But, you know, I think people at Cloud Factory, that's one thing we have in common is there's a curiosity. Oh man. English would be the only one. I speak Nepali, but really bad. But yeah, we had to learn it, you know, obviously to survive.
You've got so many people working with you that you guys have a whole bus apparently just for your team at times.
There was a few buses that, so we located our office in the suburbs and of Kathmandu, so just on the outskirts. And, you know, there's nothing there, right? I mean, it's just small little stores with like one person working it. And then, you know, we've got a company with hundreds of people that are now coming every day to work and get trained. And so, yeah, it was really cool. I mean, we see coffee shops and restaurants. There's nothing there. And all of the stuff's come up. It's not
just for you.
Well, not all of it's just for us. I mean, I'm pretty sure a couple of the coffee places we are, you know, was pretty much for us. But just even the bus lines, right? So all
the
of a sudden,
the city bus line. Just to be clear, we're not talking about you chartering a bus. You're talking about the city realizing, hey, there's so many people going to work here. We need a bus to take them in.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically private. I mean, it's kind of ran by the city, but yeah, it's people seeing other entrepreneurs, right? It's just that whole ripple effect, right? That's what we're going for, right? Is you bring work, right? Digital jobs via the internet into these places where there's just talent hotspots, super smart people. And all of a sudden, you know, we've had over 7,000 people, right, that have been earning money from Cloud Factory. And there's a ripple effect that happens when you're inserting, you know, earnings directly into the pockets of people.
Let me close out with, well, maybe this shouldn't be the last thing, but one of the last things. There are other people who do this. I interviewed Bryce Maddock.
Yeah, Bryce. Yeah,
you know him.
I know
how
Bryce.
Is his
yeah.
Different. How is his business different from yours?
I have a great moment of remembering Bryce. You know, we met at a conference, CrowdConf, many years ago in San Francisco, and you know, both were pretty early getting started. And you know, I think that they have taken a very people only. Culture-based approach, right? So they're based in the Philippines, and they work on more higher-level work now, right? So they're mostly doing call center type work, but very similar. They targeted venture-backed startups with the idea of like, we just need to build a better culture, right? I mean, like outsourcing is so old school, and a lot of tech companies just don't even know how to engage or just speaking two different languages. And so I think that's one thing we have in common is we've really targeted the same kind of startup tech company. They've done it again with trying to build a better culture in the Philippines so that they're getting better talent than the average kind of call center there. Mm-hmm. And I think we've tried to do a lot of the same thing with culture, but we've also paired it with technology, right? So I think that's kind of the key thing is we've invested, you know, a huge amount of time and money to build technology to facilitate a lot of it. So I think a lot of people would kind of say, you know, they're doing kind of higher level work, definitely a lot higher cost. And we're doing more data, repetitive back office type stuff now. Mm-hmm. And you know, that allows us to bring a lot more technology into it.
Yeah, they used to do it. I used to see on their website, right. For example, receipts featured pretty prominently. When I interviewed them, yep. That's what I saw. Now they don't. Now when I look to see how people compare the two businesses online, you guys are basically like AWS, like the spin up people fast. You even have prices on your website. The whole API is featured pretty prominently. Their site, it's like a contact us and we'll talk about how we can do business together as opposed to just spin up a team of people.
Yeah. Yeah. We've tried to productize. I mean, that's been a huge push this last year. I mean, we've seen our sales cycle has gone from about 150 days down to 15 days, right? So it's gone 10x in terms of accelerating the sales cycle. And a lot of that's because, again, we're using technology to make a online facilitated sale, you know, just productize stuff as much as we can. So we're using tech to make it easier to buy, tech to make it easier to send and receive work via API, tech to manage the workforce, tech to manage, you know, quality control of the work. So for us, again, a lot of it is, I guess, the roots of the company. I mean, we've got over 50 engineers that have been working for...
Right. You guys started as an engineering...
Yeah, 6 years now, right? So...
You know what I wish I'd done... I'd love to know how many of my listeners end up being customers of yours. And I don't want to use like an affiliate link or a special URL all the time, but man, I'm so curious.
We can do something. You inspired me with
Acuity scheduling.
Not
Acuity. Acuity scheduling is how we booked the interview. You're talking about the ads that I did, active campaign.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can throw something up.
Let's do it. And here's the thing. I don't want to get a commission. I've never gotten a commission from my guests. And the reason I don't want to do it is because I don't want you to, hold back on what you say here. I don't want to be worried about talking about your competition. I don't want us to be like in league together. I want to do the best interview and that's my number one priority. But I am curious how many of my people end up going to Cloud Factory? How many people end up coming up with ideas? So you have an idea for what we could do. What do you have in mind?
So this is definitely winging it, but we'll do cloudfactory.com/Mixergy. We'll throw up a landing page right after this. I'll get the marketing guys to put something up. But what we'll do is we'll do for the first 6 months. So anyone who spins up a work stream, we'll say, you know, we'll do it for this month, for February. Anyone who spins something up in February, we'll give 6 months at 25% off.
Okay, let's do February and like March because I'm not going to publish it until – actually, let's do it for a month after the interview is published.
Cool.
Right, because you and I are recording, just so everyone knows, we're recording February 1st with the idea that it's going to be published a little bit later in the future. All right, that sounds good. And I'll follow up and find out how many people ended up signing up and
if it's a good
fit or not.
We'll let you know.
Cool. All right, cloudfactory.com/Mixergy if you're curious about it. I'm wondering what you guys will end up doing with it. I'm really fascinated by the business. And of course, the two sponsors that I had, the company that will help you hire incredible developers. Really, we're talking about Google level developers. It's top as in top of the mountain, tal as in talent, toptal.com/Mixergy for that special offer. And if you want your email to actually go out there and bring in customers, we're talking about really heavy duty email that will work really well. That's stunningly simple. Go check out activecampaign.com/Mixergy. And I'm grateful to both of them for sponsoring. And I'm glad that we've had you on here. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Andrew.
Cloud Factory. Impressive. Bye, everyone. Awesome.